Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Alicia Yin Cheng. She is a founding partner of MGMT Period Design in Brooklyn, New York. She also serves as an external critic for the MFA program at the Rhode Island School of Design. We're talking about her new book. This is What Democracy Looked Like, a visual history of the printed ballot. Alicia, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
I love the phrases that are used in the beginning of this book to talk about ballots, that the physical representation of democracy, the most potent of all sheets of paper. Both of those are quotes from the beginning of the book. But the other thing is, it's the most fugitive of ephemera. And talk about why.
I love that phrase, fugitive ephemera. It sounds very sneaky. But it's the kind of ephemera that's really not meant to be kept. I mean, legally, it's being required to be destroyed just to, assure the integrity of the vote. But that was a phrase that was used by one of the collectors. I read an article from him from, like, the 50s. So, indeed, these pieces that we're looking at really shouldn't be in existence at all.
So, was it very tough to pull these things together?
It was, and it wasn't in some ways, because the origin of how I became interested in the subject was purely just curiosity. So it wasn't like I endeavored to, embark on a sort of chronology of the printed ballot overtly. Okay. It was an article that I read from Jill Lepore in The New Yorker in 2008 called How We Used to Vote. If you're familiar with it, I highly recommend it. And, in that, she mentioned so many amazing features of early voting and going to the polls that I never knew. But then amongst that description, she said that the ballots were colorful. And that was enough to, as a graphic designer, to inspire me to sort of look around and see what might be available to look at. So the internet had some material, but not a lot. And actually, she was super generous and, like, met me for coffee and, like, very encouraged me to pursue this. The process was not sort of like a focused research endeavor per se. It was visiting different libraries that may have had collections, and often it was mixed in with broader political ephemera. But when I started looking at the actual ballots and finding these troves in different historical societies, it was so exciting to actually hold it in my hand and sort of feel the sort of physical artifact was really quite an amazing experience.
Did it also change your understanding of the history of voting? Because I'll tell you, it did to me. I had no idea what these ballots looked like. And when I saw them, and we'll talk about design and color and typography and the whole in a bit, it was crazy. And it's not only that, like how much racism that was on it.
Yeah. And these things, I was only just finding it by degrees. It was really just sort of like marveling at how beautiful they were as objects, but then also questioning like why they were as objects. there were certain typographic features that were just, obviously an ornate kind of aesthetic quality reflected the style of the times. But there were some gestures within that still that just sort of begged further questions. And, I'm not a student of history formally. I was trained as a designer. So I was sort of freed from sort of investigating specific, say, elections or races. I was trying to sort of look for the ballots for those particular political events. I was just looking for cool-looking stuff. And so that actually kind of freed the way I sort of curated the selection that you see in the book.
And there's cool-looking stuff in here. Pretty wild. Now, just a question. Before there were printed ballots, how did people vote?
Well, I talk about corn and beans, which is a pretty straightforward method. But, you go back to sort of the Roman times when people would do like a black ball or a white ball or little stones. I mean, you recognize that is a very straightforward way to, get a quorum's opinion. But, with a greater scale, you can't do raised hands as much. There's also a good story from Kentucky where people lined up on either side of the road to sort of indicate their preference for a particular candidate. So it really was more of a scale issue that forced the use of paper as a much easier way to sort of record a larger body of people's votes.
One thing you can't avoid is, and you talk about this in the book, that the social history of ballots is linked to the history of suffrage. Who has the privilege to choose our leaders, who for an awful long time, obviously, were white males?
Absolutely. And landed white males.
That's right. It can't. It couldn't just be anybody. Like in Massachusetts, it had to be good citizens, not vicious in life.
Yes. Upstanding landed gentry, ideally, was what the targeted demographic. But it was also interesting reading the history and sort of description. It was white and not copper-colored, for example. Like they really realized they needed to create more specific distinctions in order to keep, keep those away, to sort of privilege the suffrage that they wanted.
The other thing that becomes obvious, especially in the late 1800s, the variety of political parties was crazy.
Yes. There is a smaller figure in the book that shows like a timeline of American political parties in the 1800s, and it looks like a big pile of colorful spaghetti. It's kind of amazing because, you know, looking back in our day now, you know, I mean, it's partisan vitriol between two parties, but imagine that times like 10 and 20 times that, where you have multiple factions and different platforms establishing themselves as individual parties. And so, you know, it makes for a lot of party tickets. It makes for a lot of elections. It makes for a lot more people able to vote. So, you know, what we're experiencing now is people are referring to election fever. That was much more the norm back in that time.
Well, there were even different kinds of Republicans and Democrats. There were liberal Democrats, regular Democrats, Labor Reform Party, the Greenback Party. And then the regular anti-Chinese party, which there were even racist ballot pictures that have to do with that.
I mean,
that was, I never knew. I mean, I knew about the anti-Chinese policies, but I didn't know that it filtered down to the actual ballot.
Right, but just sort of the ballot itself was used as a piece of propaganda.
Well, you could put phrases on it, like little advertisements of like candidate sayings on the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, you could put slogans, you could put, you know, a likeness of your candidate. There's this great series of sort of like really awesome mustaches.
Oh yeah, really big mustaches.
Exactly, they're really impressive specimens. But no, it was an opportunity for the parties to, you know, continually express what their platform and planks were. So the anti-Chinese one, not to excuse it at all, but yeah, those are shocking to us now. But, you know, you have a lot of varieties on ways where you can show a Chinaman getting booted back from the shores of California and various other sort of...
I never expected it to show up on a ballot.
Yeah. It was kind of amazing to just sort of see and in and around. It's not even the really explicit cartoonish ones. They're also ones that have, you know, quote unquote, sort of more standard looking appearances. But then the slogans are, you know, no Negro or Chinese suffrage, sort of gently, you know, in the banner around the bald eagle's talons. So it was definitely part of, you know, a very overt political stance for many people.
And then there was a period where there were symbols for each of the parties. And that sort of seemed like it was getting out of hand. There was like roosters and all this other stuff.
Well, that was the introduction of that was also a fascinating history unto itself, where, you know, roosters and, you know, the hammer and the fist for the Labor Party, they became more standard representations of different parties, partly because it helps people who were more literate understand that maybe they would vote for the chicken versus, you know, the eyeball or something of that sort. So it was more recognizable. So a lot of these things, you know, speculatively could have their origins in much more sort of devious ways where people are trying to sort of focus who is voting and how they're voting.
The temperance tickets actually had scenes of drunkards like breaking up their family on the ballot.
Yeah, a cautionary tale just to make sure people were voting for the right kind of scenario.
And there's
it's a sort of visual affirmation of which direction you're voting. So far more entertaining than what we have now.
There was even a stink-eyed elk on one of them, as you mentioned.
Oh, yeah, the side-eye deer, I think, was a funny one. So, I mean, the other fascinating thing about the exploration of ballots was that it broadened the search into different sort of ways that printers were producing these.
Well,
so I was finding different kind of catalogs. So I found that actual deer in a sort of a catalog where printers could order different illustrations.
Oh, okay.
So that part was pretty fascinating.
But the design of ballots obviously follows the evolution of printing techniques. So that as printing techniques evolved and became more sophisticated, the ballots, it seemed for a long period of time, became colorful, became a lot more pictures, and a lot more things went on them.
Yeah, I mean, the use of colored inks as the sort of technology enabled the petroleum byproduct to be more stable and long-lasting, and then how the ballot appearance really is tied to the story of paper and paper making.
Right.
You know, before it used to be more based on linen, it was a lot harder to make and, you know, harder to produce. But then, you know, when people discovered, they were all experimenting with different materials, but when wood pulp was refined and used more broadly, that radically changed the whole landscape of how anything was produced. And so, too, that affected ballots and how, you know, much more quicker that printers would be able to produce them, but then how experimental they became, partly because I think the printers were probably, you know, hot-dogging a little bit, showing off the latest technology that they wanted to sort of try out.
Well, the paper itself, I mean, some of the colors that were used in some of the ballots were extraordinary, like these deep greens and magentas and stuff like that. It's amazing.
Yeah, and when you see them in person, it's really just shocking how well they have held on to their color. And there's one, two in particular that are just jaw-dropping, and they are sort of this rainbow examples. And this, again, was a great exercise for me doing the research, bringing it to different letterpress printers and being like, how do you think this was done? So sort of being able to sort of try to forensically determine how these were produced, no one had the explicit answer, but it was just made for a really fascinating bridge in time for methodologies that were used in the 1800s and we're still using today to some degree, not just voting, but sort of the letterpress printing and those kind of print production practices.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Alicia Cheng. She is a founding partner of MGMT Period Design in Brooklyn, New York. She also serves as an external critic for the MFA program at the Rhode Island School of Design. But we're talking about her book. It's both beautiful and endlessly fascinating. This is What Democracy Looked Like, A Visual History of the Printed Ballot. Alicia, talk to me about typography, because one of the things, as you get into sort of the mid to late 1800s, there's all this sort of curvy stuff going on the ballot. Like,
yeah.
They're incredibly densely printed, and it's not just straight on. It's the stuff is all like on unfurling, you know, scrolls.
Yeah. It's like this very sort of serpentine combination of, you know, letterpress printing, maybe of the office, but then the names become these like curvy, crazy kind of shapes. And that's exactly what I meant about sort of forensically looking at it and being like, what the? Like, there's no reason why that should look like that. So, you know, again, no one could give me, you know, any firsthand accounts of why. But then you sort of, I realized that I was in the New York Public Library looking at their collection, which again was an amazing other trove. And they had physical examples of these pasters, which are tiny gum slips with names on them. And they're like very small, like much small, like a quarter the size of like a fortune cookie slip. And then, you know, you realize that they would be provided at the polls or directly mailed to voters, that they would then apply them directly to the ballots. And that if you put it over a name that's in a line, it's very straightforward, but try to wrestle with trying to paste that over a curvy name, and it makes it harder. So you see that, you know, there is a correlation between all these sort of efforts to suppress the vote in ways that we can't even conceive of now.
I know there's an interesting section on election fraud in there, like, you know, versus what we're concerned about today. There were some weird things that people came up with, like tissue ballots. And the tapeworm ballot.
Yeah, those are both great examples. Unfortunately, the tissue does not exist, but, you know, accounts were of a ballot that would be printed on very fine tissue paper, but then it could be bundled in such a way where once you put it in the ballot box and shake it up a little bit, it would unfurl and turn one vote into like 15 votes. And then the tapeworm ballot, I talk about fortune cookie style. It was about the size of a fortune cookie, and they managed to, I think, get like 26 names and like 4-point type on there. And the hilarity of it is that, you know, it was a race in San Francisco, and I believe, and they did it once. And then it was the second time that they tried to do it that the election officials are like, you know what, this is ridiculous. We need some standards. So, you know, there were the tolerance for this kind of these shenanigans was really incredibly high.
Let's bring a bit also back to the setting. Like, what were people depositing the ballots in originally, and what was the polling place like in the early days?
So, you know, you would go to the, as you approach the polling station, you know, there would be booths set up by different political parties, and they'd be basically hawking their wares. There's a lot of political cartoons depicting, you know, shysters waving their tickets in your face and sort of offering a glug of, like, free whiskey, maybe a little bit of cash to sort of grease the wheels a little bit. So it was a real carnival, really, up to the moment that you deposited your ballot. And so, you know, and it wasn't always one box. I mean, there was often one ballot box, which was also fraught with, you know, voter fraud opportunities. You know, there was a story of a ballot box that had sort of hidden panels where you could put pressure in a certain sequence and out would pop a whole hidden trove of ballots again. Or examples where they would have not one box, but say seven or eight, and one representing each office. And, you know, they would switch them around a little bit during the day just to make sure people were paying attention. And again, if you're not so literate and you're knowing to try to sort of put the ballot in the third one from the left, that will void your vote. So all sorts of devious practices, not just with the ballot itself, but the process by which you register to vote, claim your ticket, submit your vote, and have it counted. It's every aspect of that whole process is part of what this study in ballots reveals.
Wow. You have a really nice sort of capsule history of William Boss Tweed in this. And yeah. I think most people don't even know the name anymore or are not familiar with it. Can you just talk a little bit about Boss Tweed?
Yeah, I'm hoping that maybe the Gangs of New York movie will help people understand at least the figure and you know what he came to represent in the latter part of the 1800s. I mean, he really emblemized the sort of profound levels of corruption in New York State and especially New York City. And so there's a quote in the book in terms of, you know, how he was testifying when they were finally, you know, initiating legislation against all of his wide-ranging corruption rings. But he was saying that it wasn't about the vote, it was about the counters. So it was just like a really baldly explicit, you know, admission of the fraud, the rampant fraud that was going on. So all of it is such an interesting tie-in to what everyone is talking about today, where, you know, in a way we've gotten a lot more devious. We're also more susceptible to much more sophisticated ways of hacking. The fundamental impulse is still there and clearly evidenced in the studies from the 1800s.
A thing that I forgot to bring up is one of the fascinating things is at a certain period of time, the backs of the ballots were printed with designs. And it, I mean, they looked infinitely collectible. Like it was awesome. A certain point in time, I'm amazed people weren't just attracted to these pieces of paper and wanted to take them home.
Yeah, well, that's probably why we have them in evidence today. But the backs, surely, I mean, if you want to make the most of all the real estate that you're offered, for sure. I mean, the backs were like a party with the business on the front. But also, it allowed, like, party watchers, those guys in the booth, to be able to hand you a ballot that was clearly distinctive for their party, so that when you walked up to submit it, they knew that you actually fulfilled your part of the deal. So there was advantages of having it be visibly much more distinctive. But then there was also accounts of, like, you know, different parties kind of creating ballots that sort of had counterfeit aspects of rival parties. So you had to really pay so much attention as a voter back then, as you do now, but in different ways.
Now, we talked about you originally deposited the ballots in what? Like I saw some strange instruments that you had in the book. They were like glass bowls, and they were all different things. Try to mix them up or something.
Well, no, it was so going back to the sort of ballot box and boxes, plural. You know, typically it was a wooden box with a lock, and that the key would be held by representatives from each of the parties. But the, you know, there was the ballot stuffers box, which is the one I was talking about, where you put pressure in different sequences. And that recognition and revealing that fraud inspired Samuel Joel Lee to create a ballot box made of glass. It's quite a beautiful object. It's sort of a circular glass bowl that's in a sort of a wrought iron frame with four pillars. It sort of looks like a very beautiful fishbowl. It has a tiny opening at the top where you would just roll up your ballot as tight as possible, sort of like the size of a cigarette, and pop it in. So you can literally see the ballots aggregating in the bowl. And that was like quite a literal kind of depiction of an attempt to sort of purify the ballot, give transparency to the vote. Unfortunately, I think it was just a byproduct of expense and production and fragility that didn't really totally take off. But you see in certain depictions, say in like City Hall artwork, et cetera, of like Lady Liberty holding one of these glass ballot boxes as a symbol of what we would hope for to retain as the integrity of the vote for our democracy.
Was it across the country that all the designs were used, or is it just regional so that somebody would have a ballot in some part of the country that looked one way and then the ballot in some other part of the country would look totally different?
Absolutely regional. And I think it's such an interesting correlation with what's happening today, because before there was any kind of regulation with specifications, everybody was on their own. And if you think of how many offices were starting to become elected versus appointed, how many more voters were available to vote after the passage of universal manhood suffrage, you could see the whole thing kind of escalating such that, you know, people were just trying to keep up with demand, much less trying to make it look like the next county over. So, you know, it has always been the case where each, you know, jurisdiction has been responsible for their own ballot production, which is kind of crazy. And that now it does seem the same level of crazy where everyone is producing their own ballot and nothing is as standardized. But it has its origins in how we, voted as an early republic.
Now comes the Australian ballot system. I never knew any of this. What is that?
Well, who knew that in Tasmania, around like 1850, they were experimenting with their own system whereby it was one ballot. So they were calling it the blanket ballot, the Australian ballot. But it was a radical new idea that the state and the federal government would regulate the format of the ballot, that the ballot would be one piece of paper that had all the candidates for all the offices listed together. And the biggest deal, which I think is the most shocking that people don't necessarily know, is that it would be cast in secret. Because before, as I was describing the sort of public carnival of Election Day, it was all public. And it was sort of seen as a cowardly act to sort of not hide your vote. And you were casting it back then, too, in front of all your peers and your community. So it was much more sort of higher public stakes. And so the advent of the Australian ballot around 1900 was a really radical shift into a paradigm that we're more familiar with now. But I'll say that accounts were not, you know, people didn't welcome it with open arms at the beginning, for sure. And it took some time to state by state get adopted.
Were they rebelling against the fact that you were voting in secret?
There was that. There was sort of that.
So they think that, like, all sorts
of cowardice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was sort of like ungentlemanly to sort of hide your vote. It also produced like some really unwieldy ballots. I mean, there's examples in the book that are not able to be reproduced at scale per se. But, you know, they're ginormous. There's tons of names. And it takes so much more time than just sort of grab your ticket from that guy, get some whiskey and pop it in the box and you're done. This, you had to really sort of pay attention, like which candidate for what ballot. And it was very time consuming, which, you know, they were saying was vexing the voter.
I missed the grabbing a whiskey part. So people would serve you a...
I don't mean to overplay that. I mean, certainly it's a mixture of colorful story, but, you know, it...
They actually did that in some parts of the United States? You could pick up your ballot and you get a shot to go?
You know, because polling places were like the schoolhouses or more often like the taverns. Or, you know, it was a way to sort of attract voters to the polls, too. So, you know, any way to kind of help grease the wheels. I mean, if you imagine if you offered free beer at the ballots.
Oh, my God. Now, talk to me. We only have a few minutes left, but talk to me about attempts to automate the system to make it, you know, sort of more foolproof.
Well, I mean, it's a good extension of sort of the reaction against the Boss Tweed level of fraud where, you know, in the sort of early 1900s, you know, it was the industrial age. People were embracing the machine. It was the automobile, the age of the telephone. People were super excited about how machines could help alleviate, you know, the sort of messy human factor of vote counting. So there was a huge enthusiasm for voting machines, but they were, you know, super heavy, super complicated, very unwieldy, and very prone to breakage. So there was an embrace of it, but then consistently you read accounts that paper was always used as a backup. So just now, as we are doing, you know, QR codes and automated scanners, you know, the paper receipt is something that endures no matter what the technology.
And it's amazing because look back at the election of Bush and Gore. which used technology, but then ended up leading to all sorts of problems of hanging chads and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call that technology per se, but that sort of...
Well, punch. It was a punch system, right?
It was a punch card that used a stylus. So the voter would have to slide in a punch card underneath a sort of a template and then sort of make sure that it was all lined up. So it was just these, you know, multiple stages in the way that a voter would express their intent. And, you know, if it wasn't done cleanly, it was underwent so much scrutiny. So, yes, but in general, the sort of thinking that, you know, touchscreens are the thing or, you know, scanners are the thing, there's not one silver bullet, clearly, but paper still endures.
You end the book with talking about the HAVA, the Help America Vote Act in 2002. Mm-hmm. Can you just, again, it's one of those things I think people weren't aware of what that was. Talk to me about what that is.
Well, that was the act that was inspired by the reaction to the butterfly ballot in 2000. And I think it's notable because, you know, that was a moment where, you know, a lot of congressional money was devoted to, you know, rectifying the system. And there was a moment, a glorious moment, where we were really focused on improving the whole system that voters register, that the way that the ballots looked and the whole sort of electoral administrative process. But it took sort of a nationwide reaction against the election of 2000 to really inspire a movement like that. And sadly, there's not the funding that is needed to really rectify the situation now that we're all so appalled by. So, you know, it's kind of a necessary evil, apparently, that the public has to have a huge outcry before anything is done. But maybe that's what we're heading for.
We're all out of time. I'll tell you, I'm never going to look at my ballot the same. It always is.
Glad.
It's going to look so boring compared to these ballots.
But you know what? We're so lucky it's boring. It's
You're right. I know.
Boring.
But just the color paper, it would be like so nice.
I know. But you start that and you just see what you start to.
Oh, yeah. It's all in the book. Lovingly reproduced, by the way, beautifully reproduced in this book. My guest tonight is Alicia Cheng. She is a founding partner of MGMT Period Design in Brooklyn, New York. She also serves as an external critic for the MFA program at Rhode Island School of Design. And we're talking about a wonderful book, and it's an amazing book. It's an art book. It's a collection of photographs of This Is What Democracy Looked Like, a visual history of the printed ballot. Alicia, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. That was fun.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.